Israel gets heckled at the International Court of Justice.
Request the court to reject the request for the modification and indication of provisional measures submitted by the Republic of South Africa.
Plus, fighting intensifies in northeastern Ukraine.
Mobile units of Russian troops are attempting to capture Ukrainian villages some 30 kilometers north of the city of Kharkiv.
And later, Republicans in Congress are trying to force Biden to supply Israel with arms, a look at the Putin-Xi summit in China, and possible ethnic cleansing in Darfur. Today is Friday, May 17th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A heckler interrupted proceedings at the World Court on Friday as an Israeli official asked judges to throw out a request by South Africa to order it to halt operations in Rafah. Israeli legal advisor Tamar Kaplan-Turgman was speaking when a woman in the audience interrupted.
The State of Israel requests the court to reject the request for the modification and indication of provisional measures submitted by the Republic of South Africa.
Liars! Liars! Enemies!
The heckler was removed by security guards after the rare protest in the Great Hall of Justice courtroom. Israel is defending the military necessity of its Gaza offensive in a case launched by South Africa, which is accusing Israel of violating the Genocide Convention. Meanwhile, in Gaza, the first shipments of humanitarian aid have reached shore using a pier built by the U.S. military. The floating pier was pre-assembled at the Israeli port of Ashdod and moved into place on the beach in Gaza, which lacks port infrastructure of its own. No U.S. troops went ashore. And speaking of aid, the Republican-majority U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill on Thursday that would force President Biden to send arms to Israel to aid in its fight against Hamas. The Biden administration suspended a one-time arms shipment to Israel last week, renewing the debate over U.S. support for Israel 7 months into the war. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill.
Israeli shelling in northern Gaza intensifying this week as the debate over U.S. aid to Israel ramps up on Capitol Hill. The U.S. House of Representatives passing a bill that would force the Biden administration to send military aid to Israel after a one-time suspension of shipments last week. The White House paused the bomb shipment over concerns that they would kill civilians if Israel used them in a full-scale invasion of Rafah, where many Palestinians fled to seek refuge. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson saying the Biden administration is going back on its support for Israel.
His actions are doing exactly the opposite. This is a catastrophic decision with global implications. It is obviously being done as a political calculation.
The White House authorized a $1 billion arms transfer this week, saying the delay does not change the United States' alliance with Israel. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
The president believes, obviously, the commitment, and we do as well, to Israel's security is ironclad, and we want to make sure that they have what they need, Israel has what they need to defend themselves against their enemies, including Hamas.
Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th last year, killing 1,200 people, many of them civilians. Israel's response, which has killed more than 35,000 people in Gaza, has some congressional Democrats increasingly concerned about U.S. support for Israel.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has ruined the world's support. He's done so by not focusing on the hostages, but by allowing his military to bomb hospitals, ambulance convoys, people's homes, to take out journalists, aid workers, including Americans. Moral compass does not bend in favor of one nation, regardless of what it does.
One historian told VOA the United States has always had to balance support for Israel's democracy with accountability for its actions. Barbara Perry is with the Miller Center for Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia.
it's not as though the U.S. has never put any strings on the kinds of support we have given to Israel through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and up till now. So presidents like Eisenhower and Ford and Reagan, Republicans particularly, have had to go back to Israel to say, we're not pleased with what we see you're doing in the Middle East.
With Israel renewing the fight in northern Gaza, the House bill has little chance of passage in the Democratic majority U.S. Senate, where some senators are calling for restraint. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy.
The United States should not take part in an assault on Rafah that is going to result in thousands of innocent civilians being killed and worsen the humanitarian nightmare that exists inside Gaza. That is a moral and strategic disaster for both the United States and Israel.
Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Off to Europe now, where Russian forces are expanding their attacks on Ukrainian border settlements close to the northeastern city of Kharkiv. It's opening up a new front in the war as Kyiv struggles to hold off the latest Russian offensive. With U.S. and European weapons finally due to arrive on the front lines in the coming weeks, how long can Ukraine hold back Moscow's invading troops? Henry Ridgewell has more.
Mobile units of Russian troops are attempting to capture Ukrainian villages some 30 kilometers north of the city of Kharkiv. Kyiv's forces released this footage, filmed in recent days, near the border town of Vovchansk. Ukraine has fired missiles from the border region into Russia. Moscow alleged that this strike Sunday on an apartment building in Belgorod killed seven people. Patrick Berry is a defense analyst at Britain's Bath University.
There's multiple reasons, I think, why Russia would try something here. So obviously to create a buffer zone, but also to test the defenses and see what's going on. But the way they're set up and the amount of troops that they have, you know, maybe 30 to 40,000, not that much armor, attacking in small groups of infantry, it doesn't really suggest that they're trying to sort of encircle Kharkiv or anything like that.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky arrived in Kharkiv Thursday, having cancelled all foreign travel. Kyiv said its defensive moves had slowed the speed of Moscow's advance. Again, Patrick Berry.
They're outgunned at about at least 5 or 6 to 1 at the moment by Russian shells.
Ukrainian forces are still waiting for the bulk of the weapons deliveries under the United States' $60 billion aid package that was finally passed last month after a six-month delay. Ukrainian lawmaker Serhii Rachmanin, a member of the Parliamentary Committee on National Security, said the United States aid is crucial, so the unfortunate pause in the delivery of arms had a significant impact on the situation at the front, and this is what we are seeing now. Ukraine says Russian jets and missiles are able to attack their positions before infantry move in. Kyiv has repeatedly asked for more air defense systems. Last month, Ukraine passed a mobilization bill to address a shortage of personnel. The next 3 months will be crucial for Ukraine, and the Russians currently have a window of opportunity, said lawmaker Serhii Rachmanin. The power of Ukrainian armed forces has decreased, and Russians feel it, he added. They have amassed quite a sufficient amount of resources, weapons, ammunition, manpower, and now they are trying to use up a maximum of their reserves. They are trying to spread our forces thin across the entire front line. Can Ukraine and its Western allies turn the tide of the war? Again, analyst Patrick Berry.
The chances of them taking back significant territory now in the medium term seem to be slipping away. Unless there's some sort of step change in Western support, a large force generation package and a long-term strategy for what success looks like, none of which at the moment are forthcoming. I think Ukraine stays on the defensive and holds what it has.
Analysts say Russia has been able to rebuild its military strength over the past 6 months with the help of China, Iran and North Korea. And that makes any future Ukrainian offensive more difficult. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky reported a difficult but stable situation in the Kharkiv region, and the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine has himself been spending time on the front lines. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
The commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine, Oleksandr Sirsky, reported on Friday that Russian troops have expanded the zone of active hostilities by almost 70 kilometers in the Kharkiv region, thus trying to force the Ukrainian side to use additional troops from the reserve. According to Sirsky, the main efforts of the Russian forces were concentrated in the direction of Strelecha-Lipti and on capturing the city of Vovchansk, with further advance deeper into the Ukrainian territory and the deployment of the offensive in the rear of the Ukrainian troops. Sirsky noted that the Russians launched the offensive much earlier than expected, but so far they have not managed to break through the Ukrainian defense lines. President Volodymyr Zelensky, in his evening address, said that Ukrainian defenses near Vovchansk have gained more confidence in the past 24 hours. However, Russian forces continue heavy shelling of the area. Zelensky also reported that the head of the Vovchansk administration was wounded due to the shelling. He also mentioned that Ukraine, together with the allies, must prevent Russia from expanding the war and force it into a real peace by all means. Meanwhile, Russian authorities reported a massive drone attack across Russia and occupied Crimea. According to their reports, in the early hours of May 17th, drones attacked the Russian oil refinery in the town of Tuapse in Russia's Krasnodar Krai. Also, Russian social media channels report an attack on the city of Novorossiysk in southern Russia. The local port is experiencing an energy shutdown. There is also a reported hit on oil storage tank at the railway station. In Sevastopol, part of the city was left without electricity due to the fall of UAV debris. Classes were cancelled in schools and kindergartens. Ukrainian authorities did not comment on the incidents. VOA cannot verify this information independently at this time. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The U.S. military is preparing to leave Niger. We'll have those details in a moment. Now, though, a look at this week's meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping. As Russia's economy is feeling the pressure of Western sanctions and the war in Ukraine, it's seen by many experts that Putin needs Xi more than Xi needs Putin. Here to provide some context is James Nixie. He's director of the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House. It's an international policy research institute in London.
Putin obviously is in dire need of and he more or less gets it from Xi. Xi is willing to give, how do I put this, half measures perhaps, maybe a little bit more than half measures. He certainly doesn't want to see a Russian loss. Xi has options. Putin doesn't. Putin has divested himself of any possibility of Western markets now. And so he needs to go elsewhere. That means the global south. It means India and it means China. And China is, of course, the more powerful and the more lucrative market of all of those options.
So what is it that Putin can offer to Xi in exchange for some of this economic help, trade help and military help?
Well, Putin can offer Xi some technological help, but most of all, he offers hydrocarbons because China does need to have multiple sources of those. It's not it wouldn't make the Russian mistake of putting all its eggs in one basket. But Russia is a considerable hydrocarbon supplier.
And what do we know about the treaties that they did sign already?
These are mostly superficial. They are almost Soviet-era friendship-style treaties which promise each other lasting relationships, and they don't really add up too much. The reality is, in fact, the two sides do differ. In fact, they have outstanding border disputes, but these are areas which they would prefer not to go into because it opens up a can of worms, and they do genuinely disagree. So the treaties are designed to make it look as though there are no problems, but in fact they are, and they're bubbling under the surface. But again, they're not as important as the need to have some form of of allies, which is, you know, partly based upon the idea that authoritarians of the world unite and that they are fearful of perceived U.S. hegemony and that they are stronger together in that respect.
You sort of touched on my next question there. One thing that Russia and China each have in common is their opposition to U.S. and European, Western European power in the world. How are they able to counter the U.S. and Western Europe? What are they doing for that?
In multiple ways. In multilateral organizations, for example, they can hide behind each other with abstentions and objections, such as at the UN, where they both, where all three sit on the permanent members of the Security Council, of course. But I think that it's more a question of combined economic weight and mutual support, which defies what the US, you know, wishes. But more, however, having said that, then China is very scared of succumbing, if you like, to U.S. threats of secondary sanctions. So, obviously, the U.S. does not want China to provide Russia with dual-use technology, which could be used in the war, and it is worried of it, and it is genuinely fearful of the very real threat that the U.S. will sanction Chinese banks if that happens. They're looking for workarounds right now, for looking for non-bank transfers, effectively. And but again, the more that they can use their combined weight as far as is possible, then the more that will help. However, I do think that there are limits to the so-called limitless friendship between the two countries, which is something Putin is determined to play up, but the Chinese are determined to play down. And I think one thing that would change this calculation, change everything that we're saying, in fact, Steve, is that if Russia were to begin losing the war in Ukraine, then I think China would be happy to drop Russia like a ton of bricks. Nobody likes to be with a loser. That's just not what's happening right now.
Now, we've been talking a lot about Russia's invasion of Ukraine and, of course, the Chinese support and help to Russia. China is involved in its own security issues in the South China Sea, in the Straits of Taiwan. What is Russia able to provide with respect to those issues?
Well, at the moment, it can't provide any real substantial military hardware, partly because I think the Chinese respect it as being good enough, but also because Russia needs it for a prosecution of its own war in Ukraine. But I think the most important thing that Russia provides is, if you like, rhetorical support. Russia would be quiet were the Chinese to decide to make a move on Taiwan. Of course, whether they do that or not is at least partially dependent upon Russian success in Ukraine. If it is seen that the West effectively betrays Ukraine, allows Russia to walk on in, and simply can't do anything about it, then of course they're not going to manage to do it. If they can't manage to defend Ukraine, then they won't manage to defend Taiwan either, of course. So that's why China is watching the war in Ukraine with very hard eyes indeed.
James Nixie of Chatham House in London. Mr. Nixie, thanks for your analysis this morning.
Real pleasure, Steve. Bye.
And now to Africa, where U.S. and Nigerian leaders have continued high-level talks on Friday on plans to withdraw all American military forces from the country. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more on how the withdrawal will affect counterterrorism missions in the region.
A U.S. military official has told VOA that U.S. and Nigerian leaders agreed American forces will begin a phased withdrawal from Niger in the coming months, after being in the country for over a decade. The official added that participants in negotiations this week confirmed protections and immunities for U.S. personnel. Officials in Niger also approved diplomatic clearances for the withdrawal flights to ensure smooth entries and exits during the pullout of U.S. forces, who were in the country to help local militaries combat Islamist terrorists in the Sahel. Bill Raggio is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Countries like Mali, like Niger, like Nigeria, Burkina Faso, these have seen an expansive rise in jihadist movements. These are some of the most dangerous areas in the world.
The United States spent more than $100 million building a drone base near the central Nigerian city of Agadez to surveil Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and other terror groups. Because of the withdrawal, the U.S. base will end its drone surveillance there about 5 years after drone operations began. Carla Martinez-McKine is a political science professor at the University of Buffalo in New York.
Niger was somewhat of a rarity in the sense that it had one of the few democratically elected governments in the region, and also a democratically elected government that was friendly to the U.S. and willing to host a U.S. military presence. And so finding a replacement for that, for a military base, is going to be somewhat difficult.
Martinez-McKine says the U.S. will likely reach out to neighboring Chad to base more American troops following Chad's presidential election earlier this month. Chad and the U.S. are currently reviewing their security cooperation agreements. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
And finally today, a new report by Human Rights Watch has called on the United Nations and the African Union to place an arms embargo on Sudan amid ongoing ethnic cleansing in Darfur. Henry Wilkins speaks to the author of the report, who says the response by the international community has been disappointing.
A May 9th report by Human Rights Watch details what it says is the ongoing ethnic cleansing being carried out by the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, and its allied militants in the Darfur region of Sudan. The report says the RSF, an ethnic Arab paramilitary group, has targeted the non-Arab Masalit people, killing thousands, although the report did not specify how many. The UN says about 8.8 million people have fled their homes in Sudan since the fighting broke out in April of last year. The report calls on the United Nations and the African Union to implement an arms embargo on Sudan to help prevent further violence.
There are many lessons learned that the international regional community seems not to grasp or move forward into action to prevent further atrocities. We've been raising the alarm bell, even, as I mentioned, you know, from 2020 onward, on the ongoing attacks on civilians. And we haven't seen a proper response from the international community.
Osman says neither the UN nor the African Union had acted on the report.
But so far, we haven't seen any movement or response from these entities towards the recommendations that we provided.
The African Union did not respond to VOA's request for an interview, nor did the Office of the UN Secretary General's personal envoy to Sudan. In April, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said crimes against humanity may have been committed in Darfur and has since expressed grave concern about the ongoing fighting. Osman, meanwhile, expressed his frustration.
I think we need to have a conversation around the moral and political responsibility at the same time, because you can't come forward saying you stand with the people of Sudan and continue to express your solidarity, but in terms of action, when people need it, you're not going forward with that.
Osman says the international community must work together to end the crisis, bringing those responsible to account, aside from implementing an embargo.
I think bringing Darfur and the situation in Sudan to the focus on the agenda, you know, engaging with the Sudanese stakeholders, not only the political or the military elites, you know, talking to civilian groups, you know, talking to civil society, talking to the displaced and refugee communities.
A UN peacekeeping force that had been sent to Darfur after the 2003 genocide left the region in 2021, prompting a renewal in the targeting of Masalit and other black ethnic groups. Analysts say the civil war that began in Sudan last year has made matters worse and led to a breakdown in law and order. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.